the best of the Albert Mohler Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We continue to track issues in Pinellas Park, Florida. It seems that this nation is just going on with business as usual, but it's a good thing that there's a steady drumbeat of conversation in the media about this, and I find that an encouraging sign. We're all praying for Terri Schiavo and for her family. We're all aware that what's at stake here is human dignity for the entire human race. It's not just about one woman whose husband has decided to remove a feeding tube and to remove hydration and has been supported in the courts. It's about all of us. It's about whether we're going to decide that some human beings are simply unworthy of life and whether we're going to buy this quality of life argument in which we're just going to put certain human beings out of our minds and frankly, out of existence. When human dignity is discounted for even one individual, it's discounted for the entire human race. And time again, we are reminded of this. The murderous 20th century should have taught us this lesson so clearly, but now we're facing it in the case of this one woman in Florida. International attention is focusing on the United States as if we are an odd people to have this preoccupation. But I'm thankful that there is at least enough residual moral sanity in this country that we know this is important. And of course, we as Christians know why. It is because life is God's gift to be protected at every stage, at every age, in every condition. That's the bottom line. The situation of Terri Schiavo is another reminder to us that we face a very, very acidic, very, very aggressive anti-Christian bias in the mainstream media. We looked at that when they labeled Dr. William Cheshire as a bogus pro-life fanatic. And when you had editorials and editorial cartoonists trying to suggest that some kind of radical religious fringe was behind the concern over Terri Schiavo's life, you know, that's really hard to sustain, but if you want to look at the most egregious example that I've seen lately, you need to look at the March 27, 2005 edition of the New York Times and an article by Frank Rich, who was at one time the theater critic for the New York Times. Frankly, he was better off as a theater critic than as an editorial columnist. In an article entitled The God Racket, From DeMille to Delay, he takes on the Schiavo situation, and this is what he says. The religio-hucksterism surrounding the Schiavo case make Cecil B. DeMille's Hollywood Crusades look like amateur night. This circus is the latest and most egregious in a series of cultural shocks that have followed Election Day 2004 when a fateful exit poll question on moral values ignited a take-no-prisoners political grab by moral zealots. He just goes on and on attacking the Christian convictions of many Americans and suggesting that the only reason anyone would oppose the removal of the feeding tube on Terri Schiavo is because of some religious zeal that is grounded in some kind of fringe fanaticism. Now, let's just thank him in a backward way for reminding us of the fact that this really is a worldview collision. That it really does come down to how you define human life and whether or not you believe that human beings are special and unique because we are made in God's image, or whether you think humanity is some kind of cosmic accident. If you believe that we are made in God's image, then you understand that human life is to be protected at every stage, at every age, under every condition. If you believe that we're nothing more than a cosmic accident, then we can redefine all this at will. We can remake humanity. We can take evolution into our own hands. We can do all this. I think we owe Frank Rich an awkward and backward sense of appreciation for making clear exactly where the cultural elite really, really lies in terms of moral conviction, in terms of an understanding of human life. We really need to understand that he's helped us to see where the cultural elite holds their beliefs and how they would frame this issue. Frankly, it's good to know where we stand, and where we stand is that we're being labeled some kind of fanatical fringe by the cultural elite. Now, the good news is that there are not a lot of people who follow this kind of argument. After all, the old gray lady, as the New York Times is known, doesn't have more readers these days in terms of the people who are doing the voting and the shopping and the decision-making in America, but it does have a disproportionate effect in the elite, and that's why it is important. You know, after November the 4th, after the 2004 elections, there was a lot of discussion about red and blue America, red and blue states, and all the rest. But even after the elections last year, it's real clear that we're facing a growing cultural cleavage and a more aggressive worldview collision than ever before. Folks, I have to say, I found some weird delight in reading a Human Rights Record of the United States report released by the People's Republic of China. Now, you know this is going to be good. Now, as you know, the United States government, through the State Department, releases reports on human rights abuses and the state of human freedom all around the world, and would be expected, some very clear words of condemnation about the communist regime in mainland China. But now, in order to reverse this, the Chinese government has released this document. It's known as the Human Rights Record of the United States in 2004, released by the Information Office of the State Council of the People's Republic of China. Well, it's got good stuff in here. Now, by the way, some of this stuff is what we need to see. We need to see ourselves as the world sees us. But quite frankly, it is impossible to see ourselves as the communist Chinese see us. I have one little word to say about this, and you would think that if they're hoping that this would be effective propaganda, that they would at least learn how to use the English language. I mean, it's not that it's that hard to find people who can write. There's some hilarious editorial gaffes in here, as well as factual errors, and they have no idea how to make some subjects and verbs agree and all the rest. Just take this sentence. The Declaration of Independence said all men are created equal, so the gap between black and white people is simply an insult to the founding essence of the United States. The founding essence. I think we know what they mean. Nonetheless, they go after several different categories of what they identify as human rights abuses. Now listen to this. The U.S. freedom of the press is filled with hypocrisy. Power and intimidation hang over the halo of press freedom. The New York Times published a commentary on March 30, 2004, saying that the U.S. government's reliance on slandering had reached an unprecedented level in contemporary American political history, and the government prepared to abuse power at any moment to threat potential critics. That's just the way they wrote it. They go down on this. They said, on July 16, 2004, the U.S. State Department made a regulation in violation of the norms of most other countries that foreign reporters should leave the country while waiting for the valid period of their visas to be extended. The annual report of the Native American Journalists Association criticized the U.S. administration for the move, which severely infringes upon press freedom. They cite the Associated Press story, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know what's weird about this? With a straight face, they cite our media. They cite U.S. government reports. They cite information that's freely available not only to American citizens, to the world, in order to criticize the United States. Well, guess what? The very fact that the New York Times and others could make these statements is evidence of press freedom. No one is in jail for writing these articles. No one is in jail or has been intimidated or arrested for revealing this information. This is all out there in the public. That's the charade in all this, and frankly, it's laughable. But what's not funny at all is the real repression of the government of the People's Republic of China. And we as America, as a nation, we make mistakes, and we can violate human freedom. Just think of some of the atrocities that we've learned of, not only in terms of America's past, but even more recent history. But here's the difference. We talk about them. They're revealed openly. There are hearings, and there is recourse for the citizens of this country. We are not left merely having to find out from the foreign press where things stand in the United States of America. We have freedom of the press. Now, is that a perfect system? Absolutely not. But you know what? The People's Republic of China, in order to document all these supposed human rights abuses in the United States, had to go to the American media as their authority and source of information. You don't find that in the United States government's report about China. There is no freedom of the press. There is no freedom of access, no freedom of information. It says something that the People's Republic of China felt that they had to release this report. It tells us that, indeed, our reports on their repression have taken a toll. We talked on this program some time ago about Natan Sharansky's book, The Case for Democracy, and that famous former Soviet dissident makes the case that, inevitably, repressive regimes fall of their own weight. They have to end up eventually expending all their energy just trying to support themselves and buttress their own claims and power, and eventually it all starts to fall down because no regime can enduringly exert that kind of influence and energy just to repress its own citizens and to puff itself up. I think in the internet age, in a postmodern culture, in a high-tech age such as ours, in an age of rampant travel and mass communications, I don't think that the communist repression of the Chinese mainland government can last. I think they must know they're on their last days. Not only do they have capitalism beginning to break forth in that country, but there is also a desire for freedom. And that freedom must include religious freedom and a freedom of worship. That's why it was so important in recent days when U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, when in the People's Republic of China, went to church on Sunday and made a clear statement of the United States' determination to make clear that freedom of worship is one of the essential freedoms that is not only ensconced within our Constitution, but is also given to us by God. You know, we as America have a lot of problems, But I'm thankful to live in a country where, even on this radio program, we can talk about those problems. We can have an open conversation. And I, as a Christian, can speak on the basis of Christian conviction. I can speak claiming the authority of God's revealed, inerrant, and infallible word, and I don't have to fear being arrested. That's why this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. This is the kind of conversation that could not take place in the People's Republic of China, but it can take place here. I'm glad you joined us today. We're here to talk about the issues that matter. We don't have to worry about living in a fear society where we're going to be arrested. Now, we face an anti-Christian bigotry from the cultural elites, and we need to call that what it is. But the very fact that we can talk about it affirms that there is freedom in the United States of America. Let's exercise it. Let's keep it. Let's protect it. Let's be thankful for it. I'll be right back with Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back, America. You know, the issue of abortion has been so hotly debated now in America for over 30 years that you may think you've heard everything, but I don't think so. You may think that you've heard the pro-abortion argument put forth in its many different ways, and you've already taken all that into account. Well, there are those who advocate abortion who are now rethinking how to make the case for abortion. And the most remarkable article along these lines I've seen is by a man by the name of Andrew Johnson. He holds a Ph.D. in bioethics and philosophy from the University of North Carolina, where he has taught courses in bioethics. He has written an article entitled How Not to Argue for Abortion Rights, and it's published in the February-March issue of Free Inquiry magazine. Now, that's a magazine on the political left, and in fact, I've written about that in my internet commentary, talked about it on the air. But what you see in this magazine and in this particular article is the shape of the future on the question of abortion. And it is, as I've already said, about as frightening as anything I have ever read. I read this as I was on the airplane the other day, and I just simply could not get it out of my mind. I wrote my internet commentary about this article, and it was published on Tuesday. You can find it by going to albertmueller.com and just look under the internet commentary. Go back to Tuesday, and you will find it. I want to tell you what Mr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson, is doing in this article. Number one, he is arguing that the pro-abortion movement is losing steam and it's losing political capital. Now, I agree with him on that. I don't agree with him with much in this article, but where I agree with him strongly. I agree with him that the pro-abortion movement is running out of steam. Now, the evidence of that is, for instance, the successful passage of the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. The successful passage of the laws that in many states have been very clear about parental notification, even where the courts have struck those down, there is clear popular support for those laws. Polls, surveys, studies indicate that the vast majority of Americans are very uncomfortable with abortion on demand. And for that reason, and just remember, we have abortion on demand in this country, not because of a legislative action, not because the people of the United States demanded it, but because a simple majority on the U.S. Supreme Court decided it in 1973. That's why. But how not to argue for abortion rights? The article by Andrew Sullivan, what does he say? He says that the pro-abortion movement has been using wrong arguments. The wrong arguments. He says some of them are unsustainable, some of them are simply false. Now, you've got to hear what he's doing in this article. Listen to this. He says, argument number one that the pro-abortionists use is this. A fetus or embryo or zygote is not yet a human being, a living human being, and thus it is not wrong to kill it. He comes back and says, that's simply not true. The fetus is alive. We know it now. In pre-modern times, it was perhaps justifiable to pinpoint the beginning of life at quickening. That's the baby's discernible movement in the womb. This being the first externally observable sign of life. Modern technology, however, has revealed to us that even the zygote, formed by the union of sperm and egg, is an organism that is continuously growing and developing. The second claim is that the fetus is a human being. This claim is rendered true by the fetus's possession of a complete human genetic code programmed to direct the development of a human body. Now, folks, don't miss this. This is a pro-abortionist arguing that the abortion rights side of the argument has been using false, patently, obviously false arguments. And the first one is that the fetus is not a living human being, and thus it is not wrong to kill it. He says it is a living human being. Stay tuned. There's more. He holds up pro-abortion argument number two. Early to midterm fetuses lack moral standing because they are not yet viable. He comes back and says that's ridiculous. That is not an intrinsic characteristic of the fetus, but it's a relational characteristic. And he furthermore says, let's face it, viability is going younger and younger and younger and younger. A 28-week-old fetus had no hope of surviving outside his mother's womb in 1900, but by 2000, technological advances had given it quite favorable prospects in such a circumstance. Listen to this next sentence. Yet it cannot plausibly be thought that the moral standing of a 28-week-old fetus was different in 1900 and 2000. That's a shot right across the abortion rights movement. Argument three used by the abortionists. Abortion must be kept legal so that it remains safe. Criminalizing abortion will lead to back alley abortions with coat hangers, endangering the health and lives of women who sought abortions. He comes back and he says, that's ridiculous, because it begs the question of whether abortion itself is an evil, and that it will be worth, morally speaking, having abortion criminalized, even if that would lead to back alley abortions, if it would save a specific and large number of babies who would otherwise be aborted. That's clear thinking. He's with us on this one. Argument number four, abortion must be kept legal because criminalizing abortion would infringe a woman's right to privacy. Now, isn't that the one we hear more than anything else? You see, I think right now this is the first argument being used by the abortion rights movement. It's about a woman's right to choose. It's necessary for her equality. He comes back and says, that's ridiculous too, because it's not just about the woman. It's about the woman and a baby. This is not just a woman's suffrage movement issue. The woman's claim to equality is not absolute, and it comes into conflict with what he or she takes to be another human being's inviolable right to life. Argument number six, used by the abortionists, a right to abortion follows from a woman's right to control her body. So good so far, says Mr. Johnson, but it's not just about her body. It's also about the body of the fetus. And thus the argument that it's just about a woman's body and about her liberty to define her own body and what happens to it, it runs aground on the fact that it's the baby's body, another individual human being's body, that is destroyed in the abortion. There's more. He takes these arguments apart one by one. What he says here is that the entire abortion rights movement is based upon arguments that are, these are his words, either question-begging or unsound. So where's he going to go from here? After all, I've already told you, he's for abortion. He wants the abortion rights movement to reframe its argument. But where do you go if you knock down all six of those arguments? Well, you go to something new. Now, it's not absolutely and categorically new, because others have made this argument before. But I have never seen anyone argue that the pro-abortion movement, the abortion rights movement in America, should take this argument as its main argument. That's the new part of this. That Mr. Johnson's arguing that the way forward in the abortion rights debate to defend the right of abortion is to make this argument. What's his argument? Listen to this. There are human beings who are not persons. That's it. He says we need to concede that the unborn baby, now notice, not just from the moment of late-term pregnancy, but from the moment of conception. He says from the moment of conception, we should recognize that this is a living human being. And then he says, so what? That doesn't mean it's a person. He says a human person has to have certain characteristics. What kind of characteristics? Intelligence, autonomy, self-awareness, emotion, future regarding intentions, and moral responsibility. Where you do not have those qualifications, he says, where you do not have those characteristics and qualities, you do not have a human person. A human being, he says, does not have any innate right to life, only human persons. Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the ethicist, the ethical principles, the ethical framework of the Third Reich. If we make a distinction between human beings and human persons, then we can kill anybody. We can come up with a list of qualifications of what it takes to be a human person, and we can decide that on racial grounds, educational grounds, we can decide that on grounds of intelligence, we can decide that on whatever grounds we want. That's exactly what happened in Nazi Germany. That's how you ended up with the death camps. Auschwitz, Birkenau, Treblinka, that's where this leads. Mr. Johnson says he thinks this will sell in America because it will cut off the pro-lifers who are arguing that the fetus is a living human being. He'll simply concede that and say, yes, it is a living human being, but so what? It's not a human person. Listen to this statement. Mere membership in the species Homo sapiens should no more accord moral standing to human beings than mere membership in Culex pipiens accords moral standing to common house mosquitoes. That's right. Human life, no more important than insect life. Until Mr. Johnson decides we have a person. I think we have a topic for conversation. Give me a call, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. This is too important not to address. It's time for you to call, and I'll be right back.
The best of the Albert Mueller program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back, America. We're talking about the issue of abortion in a dark new light. The light of one who is now making the argument that we must make a distinction between human beings and human persons. Human beings are expendable. Human persons are to be accorded certain rights. Andrew Johnson's making this argument in the February-March issue of Free Inquiry magazine. His article's entitled, How Not to Argue for Abortion Rights. In a fascinating series of paragraphs, he just destroys all the common and customary pro-abortion arguments. He proves that they are either, as he says, question, begging, or just baseless. But what he does next is nearly breathtaking in its evil nature. He says we just need to go on and argue, take as the main point of a pro-abortion argument, the fact that it is lawful and it's not immoral to kill living human beings who are not, by his definition, living human persons. Now, folks, let's just talk about what it means to be human for a moment. You know, this is just one of the most important issues we could face. What does it take for you to be recognized as human? Now, I'm going to give you a Christian worldview perspective on that. Grounded in Scripture, we come to understand that human beings are special, significant, set apart from all the rest of creation, even all the other thinking beings, because we alone are made in the image of God. Therefore, every single human being, from the moment of conception, is made in the image of God. Being human means that you have dignity and should be accorded full respect simply because you are made in the image of God. There's no further qualification necessary. But right now, in the world of philosophy, in the world of ethics, and apparently in the world of law, there is a debate as to whether being a human being also means you're a human person. And there are some who are arguing that to be a human person, you have to have certain qualities. Dr. Johnson, the author of this article, lists intelligence, autonomy, self-awareness, emotion, future regarding intentions, and moral responsibility. Peter Singer at Princeton University, one of the most dangerous men in the entire world, I would argue, in a chair of bioethics at Princeton University, argues that newborn infants and very young children do not yet possess these capacities. Thus, he has argued in print that for a mother to kill her own living child should not be considered murder if the child has not yet acquired these characteristics. And as I recall, he lists communicative ability among those characteristics. So before a child learns to communicate, he or she is just simply not a person. And if he's not a person, then it's all right to kill him, according to Peter Singer, by the way, who is quoted in this article, and Douglas Johnson, the author of this particular article. I want to know what you think about this. This is a seductive logic that fits the culture of death perfectly. If you were writing a cultural script for the pro-abortion movement, if you were writing a recipe for cultural and social and civilizational disaster, I don't think you could do any better than this. I want you to hear another statement he makes. Listen to this. The denial of fetal personhood, incidentally, is not a denial that a healthy, late-term fetus has developed a number of mental capacities, among them a degree of perception, memory, and susceptibility to pleasure and pain, capacities that pro-lifers are fond of pointing out. What pro-lifers fail to notice, however, is that these capacities don't elevate the moral status of the fetus above that of a typical farm animal, which is clearly not a person. Indeed, on account of their greater intelligence, mature farm animals resemble persons more than fetuses do. To imply otherwise by brandishing images that display fetuses' humanoid appearance is to commit the fallacy of speciesism. Arms and legs and fingers and toes are not the basis of moral standing. End quote. Did you hear that? Do you understand what he's saying here? He is saying that just looking like a human being and being a human being by identification with the human species is not enough to say that your life is meaningful at all. Now, if this can be true of fetuses, as Mr. Johnson is arguing that it is, it can be true of Jews. It can be true of gypsies. It can be true of homosexuals. Three groups targeted by the Third Reich as life unworthy of life. It can be true of any group we would want to identify, any group we would want to exterminate. This is the logic of genocide. It is the logic of the culture of death. It's the logic that is put forth in this article. And he is arguing, beyond the argument itself, that it should become the platform, the basis, for the public argumentation of the abortion rights movement. We see the reality clearly now. This article helps us to see what we're up against. Ladies and gentlemen, are you willing to accept a distinction between human beings and human persons? Join this conversation by calling 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The moment we accept that distinction, we've just bargained away human life. The precise nature of the disaster that follows is just a question of choice and circumstance, no longer of principle. 877-893-8255 is the number. Give me a call. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back, America. We're talking about this new argument on behalf of abortion. Truly frightening. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've read anything lately that has sent chills down my spine like this particular article. And its author, Andrew Johnson, writing in Free Inquiry magazine, simply argues that we need to make a distinction between human beings and human persons, and those who don't fit his definition of personhood can be exterminated, killed, whether in the womb, obviously, or later. There's no reason why this logic doesn't apply to beings outside of the womb, to human persons outside the womb. Let's go to Frank calling from Cleveland, listening on WHK Radio. Frank, go right ahead.
Dr. Mohler, thank you for taking my call. And by the way, my compliments to you on your crosswalk commentary today. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, thank you.
I think we owe this gentleman a debt of thanks, really, because he has very clearly pointed out the logical absurdity of the rationale behind the culture of death. And for the folks out there who aren't familiar with this guy, you can read his bio in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 3 through 5. I mean, I read your crosswalk commentary regarding the ethicist, it immediately brought that passage to mind.
Yeah, I can understand why, Frank. And I think you're right. I agree with you entirely when you say he's done us a favor by writing this article. Now, I'm scared to death by the ideas in it, because I realize that these are not just his ideas. As a matter of fact, he footnotes others, most specifically Peter Singer, whom I've mentioned from Princeton University. But I think what we're seeing is desperation on the pro-abortion side, and that's leading to the fact that they're running out of arguments, and this is about all they have left. And this is the raw face of the abortion argument right here, that some human beings simply don't deserve to live. Frank, thanks for your call. I really appreciate it. And I think when we start thinking about articles like this, we realize that we've got to read the other side's mail. I mean, that's the bottom line. We have to read what they're talking about. And that's why in my commentary and on this radio program, I try to look at the arguments being made by the other side so that we can know what we're up against. For far too long, Christians have been outthought by the world. And it's because, quite frankly, they are out in front of us pushing for these issues before we often have arguments against them. That caught the church by surprise in 1973. It must not be true now. Let's go to Bill, also calling from Cleveland on WHK. Bill, go right ahead.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. The last caller, I agree with what he's saying to a certain extent, but it scares me that this is being said out there. I mean, on one hand, it sounds almost so absurd and unbelievable that, you know, nobody could possibly agree with this guy. But then again, you know, abortion is legal in the United States right now. So obviously an absurd concept is, you know, something a lot of people will buy into.
Yeah, Bill, hang on with me here for a minute. I want to tell you that you're so right that I could take you to faculty members in esteemed American universities and graduate seminars in philosophy and biomedical ethics, and you'd find people who would agree with this man.
Right.
The fact is, there are just so many Americans who have no idea about it, and that's why I wanted to give it attention. I think we've got to talk about this. You had another point. Go right ahead.
Well, the fact that, you know, he was talking about a barnyard animal having, you know, being more human-like. Well, that barnyard animal will never be, in his words, a human person, that human being at least has that potential. And even if it's not going to be a fully functioning human being, or in the case of like Terry Schiavo, who was at one time a fully functioning human being and now has lost that, well, to this guy, he would be snuffing her out in a moment's notice either. I mean,
yeah.
You have mentioned that this is the epitome of the culture of death. Who's going to define what a human person is? I mean,
well, Andrew Johnson is, Bill. Andrew Johnson's right here with his list. Now, thankfully, you're not going to accept it, nor am I. But I'm fascinated by this. The list could be, it does say intelligence. Well, how high in intelligence? You know, what about a child with Down syndrome? What about someone who's had a mental injury, a brain injury? You know, this is just about as frightening as it gets. Bill, you pointed us towards some of the key issues here. We're going to go very quickly to Joan calling from Louisville, listening on WFIA. Joan, go right ahead.
Hi. Just adding on to where you left off, I mean, if we started making up a list of all of the people that this could apply to, look at all the people in nursing homes with Alzheimer's. I can't remember everything that he had on his ridiculous list of what qualifies you to be a human person, quote unquote, but you could twist this around to make it whatever you want it to be if it were convenient that you were someone who wanted this person to not be around anymore. Alzheimer's, what about people with autism? Not just little babies, but the Terry Schiavos of the world who've had an injury. Who gets to decide where this moral issue is? Because isn't one of the things on the list something to do with the ability to make moral decisions?
Yeah, moral responsibility. Joan, you know, you're looking at the nursing home, and so am I. And look at the homes. I really appreciate the fact you brought up, for instance, a child with autism. His list, I'm going to read it again, intelligence, autonomy, self-awareness, emotion, future regarding intentions, and moral responsibility. Then he says among others, so that's not a complete list. But, you know, a child with autism, especially a severe form of autism, it may be alleged, doesn't have a future regarding intention. And doesn't have a proper self-awareness or moral responsibility. You know, Joan, you're looking in all the right places, because with this logic, you could go through the nursing homes and say, oh, with you, and you. You could go to the places where there would be people who are mentally handicapped being helped. You could go through and say, oh, with you, and you. Maybe all of you. You could go to the one with deformity. Maybe someone who just can't take care of themselves, and you could say the same thing. It reminds me of what we know from the historical record about Josef Mengele, the infamous Nazi doctor who stood in places like I stood at Dachau and with my family just this past summer, and then Auschwitz and others, and they would simply point and say, you live, you die, you live, you die, you live, you die, you live, you die. Why? Just because that's the way he felt. Maybe this one looked like he could work in the concentration camp. Maybe that one looked like she couldn't. This is the culture of death, absolutely naked before our eyes. Let's go to Joe very quickly, calling from Cincinnati on WTSJ. Joe, go right ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to point out some of the intellectual dishonesty of the argument the professor was making. And I think as a Christian, we need to go from an intellectual standpoint. One of the things the other caller said was about the capacity for a fetus to become a human, and he likens that to a farm animal. I think we have to just keep pointing out that, you know, they try to frame it as a snapshot in time, and they don't want to look at the capacity that a human has to grow, and I just think that.
Yeah, Joe, that point was also made by an earlier caller who pointed out that a baby is a potential human being, human person, by even this list of criteria. The problem is, what about those persons who are not able to develop in this way? I'm going to argue with all my heart that they also are human persons, fully made in the image of God, fully deserving of our protection. I don't think you disagree with that, Joe, but I just want to say that cognitive ability, it does set us apart from the animals. But what if a human being loses that ability? I don't think they cease to be human. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. There are no issues more important than this. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, folks, you can count on the fact we're going to be tracking this issue for you. This is an argument that is being newly inserted into the public square and to an incredibly tragic effect, I'm afraid. And we're going to be following this because it shows you the logic of the culture of death right out in front and forward. Just at the last of our caller segment, we had Rob calling from Iowa who wanted to make the point that Mr. Johnson is himself a speciesist. Well, you know, That's an interesting point, isn't it? It's because when you think about this list that he came up with to identify human persons, lest we be a speciesist, he lists intelligence, autonomy, self-awareness, emotion, future regarding intentions, and moral responsibility. What's fascinating is he holds out the possibility that there are human non-persons and non-human persons. He thinks some animals can achieve personhood. Well, you know what? Mr. Johnson, I'll take that seriously when my beagle shows up with his list that I have to meet in order to be considered a person. I'm not going to stay up late at night for that one. This is the idiocy of those who, in the name of political correctness, have simply lost their minds. But this isn't a mind game. This isn't a merely theoretical issue. This is about life and death. This is about life and death when it comes to someone like Terry Schiavo in Florida. You realize that this argument is immediately applicable there. Because according to Dr. Johnson's set of criteria, she is still a human being, but she's no longer a human person. Since she's no longer a human person, we can starve her to death, dehydrate her to death. This is an argument that is used of those who are profoundly deformed at birth, or profoundly substandard according to certain standards that are set by medical authorities. In today's New York Times, an incredible article about the Groningen Protocol. We talked about that. That's that list of criteria set up by doctors in the Netherlands by which they justify killing newborns who do not fit their criteria for life. They suggest these newborns are going to face a lifetime of pain. Therefore, it is lawful and ethical to kill them. These are not merely theoretical issues. As a matter of fact, when it comes to the most important issues of life, they may start at the level of theory, but very quickly they work their way down to the level of life. And at the level of life, they become legislation. They become medical protocols. They become principles and policies. They become ways and habits of life. And that's the insidious nature of all this. That's the truly haunting nature of this article. It's not only that these ideas are held by Douglas Johnson and by several others who would agree with him. It's not only that these ideas are being taken seriously, as scary as this is, in many of the academic departments in philosophy and biomedical ethics and other fields in American universities. It's that these ideas, if you scratch the surface, are where an awful lot of Americans are, because they simply do not accept that every single human being is a human person made in the image of God. Let's remember, lest we forget. We'll be back tomorrow for more Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Moeller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.